Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumba. Akapetos Aya Fa'aleava has always been compelled to speak up against social injustice. Maybe that's because growing up with seven siblings, her mother a nurse, and her father following the call to serve as a minister, helping thy neighbour was simply a part of her. When she learned about a law in her home state of Queensland, Australia, that allowed venues like pubs and nightclubs to deny entry to Pacific Islanders with facial tattoos, she spoke up once again. Using her skills as a documentary filmmaker, Akapetos made the film Illegal Ink. And she's exploring culture and tattoos once again through her PhD, which examines who should or shouldn't be allowed to wear traditional tattoos. Akapetos, talofalava.
Maloso fo malangima. Talofa.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tell me, do you have any tattoos?
I do. I have a hand tattoo, which is Tualima, and I also have the full Samoan Malu. And then I have a spine tattoo, which is was inspired by my PhD.
What do they mean to you?
They mean a lot through my identity. So it tells a story of my identity, of who I am as a person. It tells a story of my family, my siblings. By the way, there's eight of us. it also tells a story of our journey as a family and as a unit. And it also tells a story of intertwining. It's an intersection between my contemporary life versus my ancestral life and paying homage to my ancestors. So that's what my tattoos are all about.
You spent your childhood in Samoa between your mum's village of Nofoali'i and Malua, where your father worked. What was life like there?
It was amazing, I tell you. Growing up in the islands was so carefree, and every time when I go back, I always feel emotional because I miss that childhood, you know, of just not caring about what people say about me, not caring about, you know, pronouns and all this other stuff that's going on around the world right now. So growing up in the days where everything was so carefree was amazing. I really, really enjoyed growing up in Samoa.
So you're one of eight? What do you love most about being from a big family?
It taught me how to work in a team, but it also taught me how to fight for what I believe in. It also taught me how to survive on an individual scale as well as a team scale. So living with my whole entire siblings and having to put up with different personalities has really taught me how to survive in the real world, because any personality you throw my way, I'm pretty sure one of my siblings holds one of those personalities. And I'm pretty sure I hold a lot of those personalities as well. So it's always about the survival of the fittest when it comes to my family. But we also have a very strong, beautiful, loving unit now. Growing up was always a bit of a challenge for all of us. But now as adults, we've learned how to communicate better. We've learned how to work together as a team. But we also learned how to respect each other's spaces, opinions, and also where they are in life.
What was it like in school? I imagine you would have been one of the biggest families. You might have your tiffs at home, but when you're at school, were you one unit and totally loyal to each other?
At school, yes and no. I only remember school back in Samoa. And I remember I was always the loner. I was the only kid that was always by myself, which is okay. Like, I don't mind it because it made me the person that I am today. Like, I can go out to restaurants by myself and just enjoy being alone. Mm. But also, when I was growing up in Samoa, I was also a very mean person as well. I can honestly say that, and I'm not ashamed to say that, because I grew up in an environment where you either fight or flight. So I had this thing where if I don't fight them first, then be prepared to be bullied. So especially with not only my siblings, but also with my primary school peers. So, yeah, and I'm not going to sugarcoat any of that either. So that's me growing up in primary school back in Samoa.
Taking it back to your village, your grandmother had the only TV in the village. Tell me about gathering there to watch the Sunday night movie.
Oh, yes, my great-great-grandmother, she was great. So I had the privilege to actually watch her growing up. And I remember this delicate woman just walking along, and I think she was in her 90s when I was very young. I think it was a 14-inch TV. There was two in the village, actually. There was one with my great-grandma, and then there was a family in front of us, which was like an extended family. And I remember sitting in there and we were watching it. And it was really cool because we got to watch a lot of cool movies that we grew up with, like Rambo and, our Commando. We watched that, Karate Kid. You know? Yes, I'm showing my age already. And it was so much fun. But as soon as it comes to the adult part, you know, the kissing and all that, oh, no, out of here, kids. Okay, bedtime, everyone. And I was like, but it's only 7:30. Bedtime. So we all have to go gather in the house. And then we just made up our games until we all fall asleep, like, I think it's called Knuckles, when you have those five little stones and you play with them, like you try to gather them. Yeah. So we had played those. We played, there's a game called Cards Kango Kakaisu, which is like you have to smack your nose with the cards. It's like last card. Oh my gosh. And each like the spades. Nobody wants to get diamonds because they have to like, it's like cutting or something like that. Oh my gosh. Oh. Yeah, the trauma. But I loved it. I absolutely loved growing up. And thinking about it now, it's like one of the best memories that I have growing up as a kid was always in Samoa. But I can tell you this funny story, and I always tell my friends the story. When I first saw TV and I saw family in there, I just sit there and I go, where the hell are the people in the TV? Because when you look behind the TV, there's nothing there, right? There's a black box, it's just a blopper. And I was going, where are the people in the TV? And then, you know, when they have comedy, the sitcom comedies. Mm. And I was like, where are the people sitting laughing? Do these people know that there's people laughing at them? So growing up, I thought there was people stuck inside that box and they can't get out. And now I know. I don't care if people mock me on this one. I don't care. It's a story I tell all my friends because I'm in film, right? And I always tell them that story. And now that I'm in film, I know exactly how it works. And I was like, damn, I was a really naive kid growing up. You know, how did white people fit all these people inside this one little box? Like, somebody tell me.
Oh, I am curious. How old were you, Archipetos, when you found out or you realised? And who told you? How did you know?
When I found out that there's no one living in the black box. I think I was probably when we came to Australia. And there's a reason for that. So I'm going to quickly cover myself on this one. We never grew up with TV in New Zealand. We did have a TV, but it was rarely ever on, because my parents encouraged us to either read or we go outside and play. So TV wasn't really part of our upbringing in New Zealand. And even in Australia, my mom always had a TV, but it was a certain time it was on. So I never really figured it out until I was probably in my teens. That's how cuckoo I was back then. I was like, that's okay. I don't mind being the butt of the joke of the village. Somebody's got to like live up to the reputation of that. So I think I was just coming out of primary school, going on to high school, and realized it's like, oh, it's actually actors. And then that was when I really wanted to work in television and radio and films. It was when I finally figured it out and I wanted to know how to tell stories and how to put people in boxes like that.
Yeah. Your dad was a minister in a Congregational Christian Church of Samoa. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned moving around a lot. How much did you move around growing up?
Let me see. So I was born in Samoa. And then the first 3 years of my life was in Fiji. So that was our first uproot. And then we moved back to Samoa, New Zealand. And then when we got to Australia, we're like, can we just stop, please? That'd be great. Then my dad got a calling to look after a church in Brisbane. And that's how we eventually stopped moving around. But I think they were ready to move again. I was like, we're not doing this. No, thank you. So I'm grateful for my parents for being open-minded in listening to us, as well as also grateful for the church for giving my dad the calling to be a minister here in Brisbane. So moving is not fun, I tell you. It's not fun. I just want roots. That's all I want.
I imagine moving schools continuously, being younger, would be very difficult.
It was, because you need to, like, once you make friends in one school, then you have to say goodbye, and then you go to another school, you make new friends, and then you have to say goodbye again because you have to move to another school. So it was always that continuous cycle of new friends, old friends, new friends, old friends. But I'm also grateful, and up to now, that I'm still friends with people who I grew up with in New Zealand. So that's the one thing I'm really grateful for, and we're still in contact here in Australia, and we all live in the same vicinities as well, which is absolutely amazing to have that, yes, that home, away from home kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm. How different was Wellington to life in Samoa?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, let's start with my hair. Let's start with my hair. As a Polynesian woman, we take care of our hair. My hair was very straight. I want to tell you that. It was so straight growing up. It was silky straight growing up. And my mom looked after our hair so well. But as soon as we moved to Wellington, it just went from straight to curls to afro. And then I got called, Mahana, you're ugly, come and fix your hair. And I'm like, uh-uh. So leave my hair alone. Like, so that's how I got curls. Was Wellington weather gave me curls. So let's start with the Wellington weather that changed my hair. But Wellington was also different in the sense where I experienced racism for the first time, because I remember when they called me, oh, you're a fob. And I was like, what's a fob? They go, you just come out of a boat, you're fresh out of the boat. And I was like, hey, guys, Just let you know, I come on the plane, so I think I'm fresh off the plane. So that was me, because I was still learning how to speak English again. Like, I had to relearn English again. Yeah, so I didn't understand the concept of fresh off the boat, because I don't know what it's like to go to New Zealand on a boat. So, yeah, so to all the racist people out there, I am not fresh off the plane, I'm fresh off the plane, okay? And then that's where I first learned that, and I learned racism and how to deal with racism from my own people, like from my own Samoan people, from my own Pacifica community. And then hearing it from those who are non-Pacifica made it much more easier for me to accept it. And also, I was still in that mode of fight or flight. Like, you either get bullied or you be bullied, you know, like, or you just become that fighter. So I also learned how to fight and stand on my own two feet. But again, I was still very much a loner. Like, I was always on my own. There's some, like, I did have friends, but you know when you have friends and you're in a crowd of friends and you know you're friends with all of them, but you're still alone in that circle? So that's the feeling that I always carry with me. And even up till now, it's a feeling, but it's also a nice survival mechanism for myself as well. So I can be in a crowd, but I can also be alone. So that was a lot. I learned a lot in Wellington, but I think those are the two most memorable things that I learned from Wellington that I carry with me, and I appreciate it. So it's not a negative, it's a positive. Having curly hair is amazing now. Just want to, you know, embrace it. Yes. Yes. Everybody wants my hair. I was like, you're welcome. And as for the racism, you know, you take it on the chin and you either have something smart come back at it, or you just go, thank you so much. I don't know how to respond to that statement. I don't know what to do with that information, but I'll respond in a later, like later on in life.
I imagine when people are being racist towards you, you expect them to look different to you. But you were saying Pacifica people were also being racist to you when you arrived in Wellington. Is there a difference with how that feels from, say, white people being racist to you to Pacifica people being racist to you?
To be honest, the answer is actually no. And the reason why I say it's no is because racism is racism, and racism is taught. You know, you teach racism. You were not born with it. You were taught. So wherever a racism was, wherever the child or the person heard these words, and it's then they go and they share it out with their friends and they think it's okay, but it's not okay. So to me, it doesn't matter what color skin you are or how tall you are, how big you are, or how famous you are, or how unknown you are. Racism is racism, and racism has no color.
Akapetos, what were some of your responsibilities as the child of the local minister?
Oh gosh, as the oldest girl, female child of the minister, my older brother took the brunt of a lot of the stuff. I think it's just me or my older brother and my younger sister next to me. We were taught the Fa Samoa way, so we knew how to speak Samoan, not only the classical Samoans, the high chief language, but also the common Samoan. We did everything from the cultural side of things to the church side of things. Our responsibility was very high, and it was a lot to take in. And unfortunately, my brother sacrificed his willingness to go and to get an education just so that us girls can get a better future in life, because he decided to step up and look after my parents and look after the church and that. Then it got to the point where between us three, one of us has to take, you know, the step forward in advancing in not only in education, but also in our in work. And so my younger sister and I try to go through uni, but I was the one that really made it up to PhD, whereas my older brother and my younger sister stayed back and helped my parents out with the church and that. And being responsible for the church is like... it's like you make plans to go out clubbing, but you can't go out clubbing last minute because you have to cancel it because the church, my dad has to go to church function and we have to be there, you know. So we drop everything. You have no life. As a Ifakasa kid, minister's kid, you have no life. The church is your life. But also the greatest thing about my parents is the fact that they always make sure that we're paying our bills first. We're paying, our fees are paid off before we look at donating to the church. And then I was like, this is all I got, is that okay? My parents were like, that's fine, that's more than enough, let's go. So living in a minister's life as a minister's kid is a bit of a challenge, but it's also a blessing at the same time, because it taught me how to be more resilient against the criticism from the community. Because you sit there, you're there to support your parents, you're there to support the church, but you hear the criticism just behind you or just above you because you're sitting on the floor. You can hear it. You hear people saying stuff about your parents, you're saying, and you're exposed to that. So anything now, like going through my PhD and being exposed to a lot of criticism and a lot of threats and a lot of, I guess, our own people saying stuff about me, it made me more resilient, and I have a thick skin against that because the church taught me that. You know, my parents, especially my dad's ministry, taught me that.
Dad devoted so much of his life to the church. Then he was diagnosed with cancer. How long did he continue working?
He continued working until June 11th, 2017, was when he officially retired from church. And it wasn't a pretty sight, but that was the first time we've actually seen him saying, no, I've devoted my life to church. It's time for me to step down. So when my dad stepped down, we only had a month with him before he passed away quietly at home. But he devoted a lot of his time, his life, his energy to church. Anything was church. Anything that we did was church. But he also made time for us kids as well. But he tried his best that he could as a father. But at the end of it all, we knew that his heart was fulfilled because he did what he always wanted to do growing up. So that was the most rewarding thing for us, to see that.
What do you remember about that time that you had with him in his final weeks?
It was the most craziest time of my life, I tell you. So what I mean by this is like, and those who have actually seen parents deteriorate slowly in front of your eyes and you're hopeless, everybody who's seen this actually understands this when I say it wasn't a pretty sight. It was a special sight because we shared moments with him. We tried to make his life as comfortable as possible. We made sure we give him what he wanted, not what the doctor tell us to give him. Like if he was craving for something, we made sure it's on his table because we knew it's his last moments. We had to put up with his commercials. We call them commercials. It's like one day he's in a good mood, next day he's in a bad mood. So he'll listen to commercial breaks there every now and then, which is great. But you know, overall, he left a life lessons for us to live for in order for us so that we can share with the next generation of our children to come. And that is to always work as a team and to work as a family, to stay as a family, to be as a unit. And he's always made sure that we're like that. But he's already done his job. He said, I've already done my job. It's up to you how you're going to take that lesson on in life. But it was a bittersweet moment, to be honest.
How did he prepare himself, his family, and his parishioners for his passing?
He was diagnosed with cancer 4 years before he passed away. So for the 4 years, he prepared us through keeping us all up to date of what the doctors were saying, keeping up us to date what his discoveries of medicines. He also prepared us for what death would be like. He imagined what death would be like, and not to be saddened by death, because death is part of our life. It's a struggle of life. So he always made sure that we were prepared mentally, physically, emotionally, so when he's not around, we are able to move on without him in this physical world. And he made sure he passed on as much information as he could that he knew of, not only the Fasa Moa, but also the Christian side of things, his Christian faith, to make sure that we are, our stance and our Christian faith and our cultural faith is strong, and that we do not walk away from it or, you know, wither away from it slowly. So he did a good job, I reckon.
Sounds like he did an incredible job. You're listening to Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Bobby McCumber, and I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Agapetos Ayafa'aleava. Agapetos, how did the church help you hone your skills as a storyteller?
White Sunday. Everybody knows this. White Sunday. Yes. Whether you like it or not, White Sunday. Oh my gosh. I'm going to tell you guys this really shameful story, but I love telling people this story.
Please.
It's all about shameful stories today. I don't care anymore. Let's go. Let's go. So once upon a time, there was a little girl named Agapetos. And this was a New Zealand story too, this back in New Zealand. Man, my teachers knew I can't sing for peanuts. And if there was honestly an earthquake outside and Jesus comes down and say, Agapetos, if you can sing in tune, I will save the world. Jesus, you take the wheel. I'm happy to go with you. Take me, you know, because singing will not save nobody's life. Honestly, oh my gosh. But my teacher thought, nah, we just put Mariah Carey online. Like, we just put her on stage, why not? So I went on stage, and then on White Sunday, she put on, you know what happened? She ended up singing on top of me because I was that horrible. I was that scary. Oh my gosh, I was horrible. But she made me sing. So that built, I was confident though. I was confident to the days of the kingdom come. I was singing my heart out, hitting the wrong notes, but I was confident in those notes. But then I realized my microphone was off and she was louder than me. And I was like, But yeah, so White Sunday taught me how to tell stories. White Sundays taught me how to write scripts. White Sunday taught me how to argue and fight for what I have to get the story right. And I think one of my greatest memories was 2013 when I was doing my master's at the time. And my dad volunteered me to be the script writer and the director and the producer and everything for our Christmas play that the end of that year. It was so much fun. Girl, as a filmmaker, like as a theater at the time, I'm 100% theater at the time. I was like, I went all producer mode. I'm going to have camels for my three kings outside. I'm going to have the donkey for Mary, and Mary's going to like ride the donkey. I'm going to have fireworks at the end to show everybody that Jesus is born. And at the end of that, I'm going to have a petting zoo, and everybody's going to pet every single zoo animal in there. Just don't eat them, okay, people? Just don't eat the soup. Do you know what happened? I had all those and more. I had all those, yeah. So I spent the whole year fundraising. I did bingos. I did bonus, you know, you guess the bonus number and you win a prize. I was no shame at all. I was hitting, like, you know, radio stations, you know, begging, like, not begging, but, you know, promoting my stuff. You know, I even had and one of the kids from church jumped in and helped me with a festival. We came up with Kids Fest. We got sponsored. The church gave us $2,000. I was like, that's all right, we'll just make suppers for it. So we made suppers out of that. And then I went and I knocked on doors of Broncos players, you know, Queensland Reds players, you know, anybody who were like willing to listen to this little Sam Warren walking around trying to make her dreams come true. But at the end of all that craziness, I raised enough money to pay off my petting zoo, my camels, my donkey, and my fireworks. And and that night I found out that all the local churches around our church, so our church at the time is in Richlands. So all the churches around all cancel, all the Catholics, the Methodists changed their service, Christmas Eve service time to midnight, just so that all the members can come to our festival, our Christmas play. Oh. So we started inside. I had this film because I also went around my iPad and I was filming everybody and I edited this really nice remembrance film, like, kind of thing. Like, you know, remember all the people who have gone before us, congratulating all the kids going into high school and uni. And then at the end, you have all the adults saying Merry Christmas and all that and making everybody laugh. Yeah, so we did that. We went outside, did the whole entire thing. And at the end of it all, we all try to kick everybody out of the we're like, okay, it's finished now, fireworks is over, go to church now. Nobody left. We sat there for another extra 4 hours until everybody decided to leave. I was like, I've got nothing else for you guys, I'm so sorry. Okay, just socialize, that's all right, keep going as you were. Yeah, so we had to sit there and wait until everybody left before we actually had to close it all down. But it was crazy. So church, White Sunday, I like to thank White Sunday for teaching me how to tell stories. So yeah, that's my long ass answer to your question.
Oh, I loved it. It sounds like it was a huge success.
Oh, major success. I made sure of it too.
When did you realize you wanted to become a filmmaker?
I wanted to be a filmmaker by 2013. I think I've already done my rounds of the theatre scene. And I thought, I think I should go into visualizing my stories now. It's no longer about just waiting for audiences to come to theatre and watching it here and this is it, this is the experience. And then they take it out and nobody's seen it. I wanted my stories to be seen worldwide. Filming was the reason why, visualizing and extending our traditional oratory stories into and visualizing it through documentary making and filmmaking was one of the goals that I had in mind when I started to venture into filmmaking.
Yeah. What was the first film that you made?
Oh, my gosh. I think it was called Writing is on the Wall. I am never going to show that to nobody. But I think it's one of those films where it was part of my assessment. And I'm so proud of that film, by the way. But I didn't know anything about angles and the distances from the camera to the actors and all that. So it was one of learning experiences. And it turned out really horribly wrong, like terrible. But I loved it because it was one of my first achievements, you know, as an editor, as a writer, and as a director, and as a producer of this 30, this 1 minute film. And then from there we did, I think it was a year when iPods and, because I did do filming when I was doing my undergraduate. So that was back in, oh my gosh, when dinosaurs were in diapers. Oh dear. I can't remember what year it was, but it was back in early 2000 or mid 2000. So we did one when the iPods came out, you know, those little gadgets. Oh my gosh, yes. Now I'm going to start to, yeah, okay, got it. And so when the iPhones and all that came out and we're like, they're being possessed and they're going to be zombinized. So we wrote this script about people being possessed with their iPhones and they're like zombies attacking each other. Oh my Lord, it was amazing. I was rolling around on the grass because I had to capture sound and I was doing sound, rolling around the grass with this microphone mid-air trying to, like, you know, not to, oh my gosh, and I was trying to do all these ninja moves. Oh my, it was funny, it was horrible, it was exciting at the same time. But one of my success, so those are the early days, but one of my successes was 2019, one of my films made it into Cannes Film Festival and the other one made it into cinemas in Hollywood in 2019. Wow. So, so the other one was, I was a production manager for the one that made it into Cannes Film Festival, but I was a producer for the one that made it into Hollywood in cinemas. So I chose Hollywood. Oh my gosh, yeah, it was the most funnest experience, I tell you. And if I have to do it again, I would. And I think I would keep going and going and going until our stories are out there and people see and watch our stories. So, yeah, so that's my little adventures of filmmaking.
Your film, Illegal Ink, examines the prejudice of laws that allow pubs and clubs to ban patrons on the basis of tattoos. Tell me about the women who inspired you to make that documentary.
Of course, of course. So it all started when I was looking at, obviously through my research of Once a Tale, Two Worlds, I was examining the intersection of stories between Fafafine, which is mannerism of a woman, and non-Indigenous Samoan women with the Samoan Malu. So I was examining that, but then I came across the story of a PNG woman by the name of Moale James, who was rejected from the doors of a venue because of her traditional tattoo. So having her human rights and her identity denied at the door was heartbreaking for me. And I was like, you know, this is wrong because I wear traditional tattoos just like her. So I looked further into it and I realized that some of the venues there say no hand tattoos, no facial tattoos and neck tattoos, which really drove me up bananas because the people who are denying us at the door, security guards, also have hand tattoos and neck tattoos. You know what I mean? It's like double stand as much. So when I looked further into it, I couldn't look further into it further like I am now, because my PhD didn't go down that pathway. And if I go down that pathway, I'm shifting the lenses on my PhD. So I had to finish my PhD, put it aside. So Legal Ink came out of because of Moale James' story. But it was when I was filming for Once a Tale, Two Worlds in New Zealand. And I was at a, as you do, visit a kava bar. So I was visiting one of the kava bars in local Tamaki Makaurau. And I was sitting there with one of the Māori girls there. And she told me her story. And she said, you know, I went out clubbing one night and I got denied at the door at one of the venues there. And I was like, what happened? She goes, he said that my moko kawai or my chin tattoo is classified as a biker gang symbols and I can't get in. And I was like, holy shoot. But in front of her was a Caucasian guy with head tattoos and face tattoos. He stepped up and told the security guard, no, I've got face tattoos. You just let me in. You should let her in too. Security guard goes, no, you're fine. She's not. Yeah. So she was the reason why, but it was Moale James as well as Juanita McManara. Those two women's stories inspired me further to look into Pahina. So Pahina is my protagonist for Illegal Ink, look further into it. So that's my next documentary, which I am currently developing right now. So it's a story that really, it's not about more of exploring the experiences of our Pasifika people whose human rights have been denied by white security guards at the door just because of a legislation. It started off with the Vlad legislation back in 2013, then it was repealed by the Serious and Organized Crime 2016, and that was repealed again, and then it's now under this blanket law that's covered under the Liquor License 1992 Section 165, which then gives the venues any kind of, they can do any dress code that they want and not be subject to being sued or charged under Discrimination Act. Wow. So yeah, so I'm really fascinated with that story now. So it's my next adventure.
Now you're doing your PhD on the Malu, the women's tattoo in Samoa. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what the Malu is and what the symbols mean?
Of course. So the Malu means sheltered or protected. And the Malu is specifically given to a chosen high chief's daughters or somebody that is chosen by the village to be their taupo or their one of their maidens. And what she does is, like, once she gets her Malu, she is then, there's a few ways that they can, that she is used. Well, obviously her role is not only to be a peacemaker in the village, but also she couldn't be married off for to gain political alliances with other village. So when it comes to civil war, you've got your alliances there as well. So she played a very strong, powerful role within her community. And her role and the symbols on the malu reflects the navigational maps of our Samoan people when they used to navigate, Pasifika people actually, when they used to navigate the oceans, the moana. And there's also another story that came out through my PhD that there's also another specific malu that's specifically a malu, a navigational map. So, and this map has a place, and this map has the secrets of where to go fishing or how to get to a place quicker. So this is one of the research that came out, and one of the people who I shared this knowledge with who taught me this was Dr. Sunny Nataniello. So he's the one that really showed me, taught me how, like, what the other meaning of the malu is. And his work is absolutely amazing. And what the lady then has to do is she does have a special place in her boat. And she's also one of the master navigators as well. And she will be the one guiding the boat and her people through from one island to another. So the malu has got various symbols on it. The most talked about one is the bird. It's either the tern, which is the ngongo or whangongo, or is it frigate bird, which is atafa. And there is different meanings of those birds amongst all the Samoans, but I've taken that specifically because ngongo is the symbol that I have in mine, which is the tern, sorry. But the frigate bird has got two tails, and my tattoos don't have two tails on it. So the other symbol that we also have in our tattoos is the jellyfish or the walu, which is on the side of the woman's thighs. So I love telling the story. So it goes, a woman has got her fingers in all facets of her family. You know, she is the one you go to. So if a child is sick, who looks after them? The woman. She who also cooks and cleans, look after the house, and she's the keeper of the house. She's also the one who makes sure that there's always peace in the house sometimes, or she's the one who creates the chaos and then she has to create the peace herself. And the jellyfish is just like that. She's got so many tentacles and all over the place. But once you touch and you aggravate that piece, or you aggravate a woman, she becomes so deadly, you don't want to be near her. So that's what the jellyfish is like. You know, once you get stung by a jellyfish, you are like in pain for days. So a woman is like that, and that's her role in the family. So those are two symbols that I always love talking about, because it really speaks true to the empowerment of our women and our Pasifika women and our roles, not only in our families, but also in our communities. You know, whether we'll be, obviously, like yourself, radio announcers or radio producers, or we're radio or film producers, or we're in working mothers, or we're stay-home moms, or whatever roles that we have as women, whether you're a mother or a single woman or a career woman, whatever it is, we are women who can do everything and anything in life. But once you step us out, or you aggravate us, or you, okay, another word, piss us off, we will put you back in your place, because we are strong enough in our position as Indigenous Pasifika women to stand up for who we are. And that's the most important thing. And I think that's where my power and my motivation comes from when it comes to Illegal Ink. You know, and it comes to Ones That's All Two Worlds, is speaking up for the marginalized community of women who are affected by the injustice in our community. And I'm also the one who will look at controversial issues that needs to be brought to light, and we'll discuss it out and open, but not on social media or behind closed doors or in small spaces. You know, I'm that type of storyteller. And just to go back to the ngongo, I use ngongo as in whangongo, as in storytelling. And obviously storytelling is that we're oratory people, so we share stories through our experiences or through myths and legends and dances and poetry. And now we're visualizing all this that our ancestors have brought before us into filmmaking, so that can be immortalized online, so that our future generations can learn from it and carry it to the next generation.
In the documentary One Te Tau, Two Worlds, you've posed a controversial question as to whether women who are not Samoan or whether whawhawhine can have these markings. What's your position there?
My position is obvious from the beginning, and that's a yes. It's 100% yes. And the reason why I say this, and I also wrote an article about this in the Samoa Observer, is that our non-Indigenous Samoa women have served our country, served Samoa, not in a sense where they go out into the community and do community work and say, hey, look at me, look what I've done, you know, and be extravagant about it. No, they've served Samoa in a more subtle and respectful and honourable way. And a lot of these women have done that through education, through businesses, through their families. They have nurtured and carried the next generations of our Samoan people. And some of these women are advocates for our Samoan people and our issues that we're going through. And that's why I strongly believe that non-Samoans who carry the Samoan malu deserve it, but they deserve it because they've earned it. With the whawhawhine, with the malu, I also believe that they should wear the malu. But I also called out to the suluapes to maybe consider, because they're the ones who are so progressive in sharing our tatau, sharing our culture through our tatau, and sharing the tatau story, not only through their practices, but also through documentaries, their writings, their workshops. Because they've done this so well and they've been so progressive about it, why not create a new tatau just for the whawhawhine, to show their loyalty to Samoa, to show their contribution to the Samoan culture and what we've done in the community. But it's not just for Samoa, it's all our Pasifika communities. You know, and my stance is very strong on that one. And I'm not going to move. I'll consider like having a conversation, and I'm happy to have a conversation with that. But I will not be sitting in a room where people will just come and attack, attack without listening, you know, active listening. So with me, my stance here today, I say, I stand with them, and I stand with them proud.
You grew up in the church. You're a staunch social justice defender, and you've devoted parts of your work to examining your culture and the right to express that culture freely. What is your relationship now with your faith and your culture?
At this point in time, it's still strong. I still believe that, even though I'm not the type of person who goes to church all the time and sit in there and listen to the sermon, because of where my life is right now and the journey that I've taken. But I've never prioritized my life over, you know, praying and having a conversation with God privately, or reading my Bible every now and then. Like, I always see my faith as I carry my faith with me. And wherever I sit and wherever I go, and I find myself thinking and talking to myself, that's me having a conversation with my faith, with God himself, and just letting him know that I need help. You know, so my faith is always in my heart, and I carry it with me all the time.
Aka Petos, you are such a joy to chat to and interview. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're most welcome. Have a good day.
That was Samoan documentary filmmaker Aka Petos Aia Fa'aleava. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Bobby McCumber. To catch more great stories about incredible people from the Pacific, just search for ABC Pacific. This story was produced on the lands of the Yagara and Turrbal people.